One of the things I'm doing these days is reading a biography of every president, kind of started with Washington. I'm kind of working my way through those, kind of did some research, what's sort of the best rated single volume kind of thing. I've just been kind of working on that for about a year and a half, and my wife loves to tease me because, you know, she says they all look the same. The guy dies, you know. It's kind of become a running joke in our country. Yeah, this one died. You know, I don't know what to tell you. So right now I'm on Herbert Hoover. He's our 31st president during the Depression, early 1930s. And anyway, as I was reading about that, you know, you kind of see some things that are common. You know, as you kind of work through, you kind of begin to pick up some themes and what makes a good president, what makes a good leader. And I think one of the things that I've kind of taken away from that is that when we look at leaders, whether or not we agree with them or not, we like them to know what they want to do. You know, we like leaders who have a plan and a vision and a drive and who kind of say, here's who I am and here's what I'm about. And you might say, okay, that's great, I'm on board with that. You might say, okay, that's really not what I'm about, and vote for the other guy. But at least you know what you're getting, right? You've got a leader who's kind of like, this is who I am and what I stand for. Pilate was not that guy. Pilate was not that guy. And today, as we look at our portion of Luke that we're going to talk about, we see Jesus in sort of the last stage of his trial before Pilate. And one of the things that we can just know about how this ends is that not so much that Pilate made the wrong decision, but he made it for kind of all the wrong reasons. And in some ways, I think that's why he kind of has such a terrible reputation sort of in Christendom ever since. Nobody wants to, you know, sort of like the guy that sort of made the final decision to condemn Jesus to death. But I think sometimes it's more than that. I think it's more just why he did it. So that's kind of where we're headed. And we're going to just begin. I think I just want to read it to start with. So we're in Luke chapter 23, and we're just going to go through 13 to 25. It says, Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, you brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. Behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor is Herod, for he sent him back to us. And behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will, therefore, punish him and release him. And you have a C marginal note. So just think of everything Cody said about Mark 8 through 20 this morning, and I'm just going to read it. It says, verse 17, some manuscripts have, now he was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner. But they all cried out together, saying, away with this man and release for us Barabbas. Now he was the one who had been thrown into prison for a certain insurrection made in the city and for murder. And Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again. But they kept calling out, saying, crucify him, crucify him. And he said to them a third time, why? What evil has this man done? I have found no guilt in him demanding death. I will therefore punish him and release him. But they were insistent with loud voices asking that he be crucified. And their voices began to prevail. And Pilate pronounced the sentence that their demand should be granted. And he released the man they were asking for, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder. But he turned Jesus over to their will. That's how it ends. That's how it ends. Not with some sort of, you know, ultimate final event,
some sort of dramatic moment, but really with somebody just giving in to the peer pressure that he should have learned to ignore in seventh grade. Right? He just kind of gives in.
Well, where are we? We are at the end of Jesus' trial. And just to kind of bring us all up to date, I know it's taken us a month, but this has really been one real long night. Right? So just to kind of put us all in perspective, because again, we've been chunking this down almost an hour at a time, it seems. You know, we had the Passover supper on Thursday. Jesus is with his disciples. He's washed their feet. He's taught them. He has predicted the betrayal. They have worshiped together and just enjoyed one another. He's instituted what we would call the Last Supper. We had that. And then he goes out to pray. And it's in Gethsemane that Jesus has to deal with two things. First, the disappointment in his own disciples who sort of sleep their way through this prayer. And then Judas showing up to betray him. And he's arrested and he's taken to the home of the high priest, Caiaphas. And there first, Jesus is sort of interrogated by the former high priest, Annas, the father-in-law. And after a while, probably an hour or so, either Caiaphas and some of the Sanhedrin come in, or Jesus is taken to them. We're not clear which, but once again, sort of the questioning continues. And this goes on for a little while. And it's at that time, if you remember, that Peter is down in the courtyard trying to avoid the looks and glances of various servants. And finally, for a third time, states that he does not know this man. And at that moment, the rooster crows, and Jesus is being led out of the room where he was questioned, and their eyes meet. And Peter is broken. So it's the early hours now of sort of Friday morning. The Sanhedrin adjourns, and they hold Jesus prisoner, because again, even according to their own laws, which they are following in sort of a haphazard fashion, they can't officially meet at night. So they kind of put Jesus somewhere until sunrise. Sun's up, and now the Sanhedrin can't officially meet, and they very quickly pass summary judgment on Jesus. And then, now that that's been decided, they need Roman approval. So they go to the Praetorium, where Pilate is living during the Passover. He's the Roman governor of the area. Normally he does not live in Jerusalem, but he's there for the Passover because so are 100,000 or so Jews, and it's a good idea to be on the spot. They wake him up, kind of expecting him to sort of just, hey, we've arrested this guy, just sort of rubber stamp this. Pilate has some conversations with Jesus and decides that, I don't see anything here, but he hears that Jesus is from Galilee. And so that gives him a way out, right? Because Roman law allows you to be tried in the area where your crimes are committed. And Galilee is under Herod's jurisdiction. So now Pilate can kind of avoid the situation. I don't have to sort of condemn this guy that I don't really see a fault in, and therefore look like I'm giving in to the Jews. And I don't have to stand up to them and make them angry. So I'm going to just sort of pass the buck to Herod. And he ships him off to another part of the palace where Herod is staying. Herod spends an hour or so with Jesus, finds nothing worth that interests him. You know, he really, if you remember from last week, was wanting to be entertained. He wants to see a miracle or something, and Jesus doesn't oblige him. And so back he comes to Pilate. Okay? And all of this has sort of happened in sort of the wee hours of the morning, right? So now it's early morning, the sun's been up for a little while, and that's sort of been the last couple of weeks in this class and the last few hours of Jesus' life. So Pilate has a problem because Jesus is back in his court. Okay? And that is not what Pilate wants. Pilate does not want to deal with Jesus because Jesus represents an issue that he has with the Sanhedrin and the religious leaders of the Jews. Jesus is sort of the pawn in this. Okay? So, what do we know? We talked a little bit last week, and we remember that some early writings about Pilate described him as inflexible, merciless, and obstinate. Okay, that was sort of what we know about Pilate. So it's not as though Jesus could even expect a fair trial from him. John's gospel has a part that we just alluded to last week, where Jesus and Pilate kind of get into this sort of philosophical moment about what is truth. You know, Pilate asks Jesus, what is truth? And from that, I think we can take away that Pilate was pretty cynical and arrogant as well. Pilate has worked his way up, right? He began probably, again, we don't have a lot of the historical record, probably as a minor official, but he has worked his way up to the point of being the governor of Judea. So we know some things about him. We know he knows how to land on his feet. Okay, again, in our political system, if you want to sort of think, okay, how do you get to be a president or a governor? You know, you start off in local politics and you get elected and you make some friends and you kind of work your way up. And that there's sort of the system, right, if you decide that's what I want to do. In Rome, there wasn't elections. You had to please the people above you. Right? You had to stay in favor with the people in power. And as we've talked about, what Rome wants, what the people of Rome want, are two things. They want their taxes, and they want peace. Right? We want peace. Because if there's peace in the empire, we don't have to spend money sending armies out to kind of control all these sort of fringe areas, like Judea or England or wherever it might be. So if you're in charge of sort of the periphery of the empire, just make sure the tax money gets to Rome and make sure Rome doesn't really have to know too much about what you're doing. You know, it is very much a don't ask, don't tell mentality. So, that's where we are. And Jesus is back with Pilate. And we know from John's gospel that it's about, say, 6 in the morning, right? When Jesus is brought before the 6th hour. So that means that this whole coming to Pilate, going to Herod and coming back to Pilate has happened pretty quick, right? Because the Sanhedrin couldn't meet until it was sunrise. So, I don't know, when the sun came up, let's just say 5 o'clock in the morning, it gets a little bit light out. Now the Sanhedrin can officially meet. They officially meet, go to Pilate. Pilate says, I'm not just going to execute this guy for any reason. Oh, wait, well, he's a Galilean. Oh, okay, send him to Herod. Herod grills him for a while, do a miracle, not interested. Okay, back to Pilate. All of that has happened quickly. And that just, I mentioned that just to reinforce sort of the remarkable unfairness of this trial. Right? There is no interest in truth here at all. There is no interest in really getting at the bottom of this. This is something where it's just a procedural process to get to when can we execute Jesus. Okay? Pilate has figured this out, right? Pilate gets this. He knows that Jesus is not a threat to Rome, and the fact that Herod has sent him back means he's not a threat to Herod, right? Because if you remember, the card that Sanhedrin played, and again, just to back us up to get us all on the same page, the Sanhedrin convicts Jesus of blasphemy, right? That's of no interest to Pilate. He's a Roman governor. I don't care if this guy wants to be a god or not. That doesn't touch me, right? So they play the king card with Pilate. They say, well, he wants to be a king. And that's going to mean a revolution, and that's going to mean civil war, because Herod's the rightful king, and you better do something about that Pilate. That's why Pilate was happy to send him to Herod. You know, he's the threat to your throne, not to mine. Right? If Jesus wanted to be the Roman governor, then I'd have to deal with it. Right? But he wants to be the king of the Jews. Okay, Herod, you're king of the Jews. What do you want to do with him? And Herod sends him back. So clearly he's not a threat to Herod, or at least Herod doesn't think so. Right? So Pilate's figured out what's going on. Matthew puts it in there straight. He says Pilate knew that because of envy they had handed him over. This is simply an internal issue with you guys. This does not touch Rome. This is simply you religious leaders are jealous about this religious leader. That's what this is all about. Right? So after hearing that Jesus has returned from Herod, right? Pilate has probably sent him to Herod, decided to go in and get some breakfast or something since he's been awakened. And then he's hoping it's all done. And the next thing he hears is sort of a knock on the door. And his servants come in and say, hey, Pilate, Herod sent him back. He says it's your problem. You know, Pilate probably shoving himself away from the table says, fine. And he summons the chief priests and the rulers and the people. Okay? Get everybody in here. Now, here's what Pilate has to do. And this is sort of the key to the conversation. He's got a problem that he can't pass off. He has to solve. If he gives in to the religious leaders, he is going to lose his authority among them because he's going to look like they can manipulate him. Right? So if he says, okay, fine, take him, those religious leaders are going to know we got Pilate wrapped around our finger anytime we want something. And that's not something a governor would want, right? The governor would not want to know that the people I govern can sort of threaten to do whatever they want and I'll give them. If you're having trouble relating, just remember when you had a teenager at home, right? On the other hand, if Pilate simply says, nope, you can't have him, these Jews are going to cause a riot in the streets. There's 100,000 people here in Jerusalem for Passover. Who knows what that's going to look like? Rome's going to have to send in troops, and that's not going to be good either. Right? That's his problem. I can't give Jesus back. I can't not give him back. That's the problem Pilate is trying to solve. And the reason Pilate has this problem is because he has no credibility with the people he rules. We talked a little bit about this, but I'll give you a little more detail. We talked a little bit about the fact that he had not treated these Jews well. He has ruled them now for several years. Okay? And he's had some minor problems, or minor, not really problems, incidents, let's say. You know, remember last week we talked about how he used the temple, money from the temple treasury to build aqueducts? Yeah, that's really not kind of what that's for. Okay? And they hadn't really liked that. Luke had talked about the fact that there were some Galileans that were worshiping in the temple, and Herod, or Pilate had them killed. We can assume that maybe they were just rebellious people because Galilee was sort of famous for that. Those had not, you know, endeared him to the Jews. But a couple of the bigger issues had to do with his almost malicious desire to pester the Jews by defiling their temple. Or defiling things that were religiously significant to them. It's almost that he took this sort of perverse joy in this. You know, and one of them is when he was first comes into office, he brings into the temple these images that bear, these banners that bear the image of Caesar as a god, right? Because at this point, Caesar is being worshipped sort of as a god, and he brings those into the temple. You just can't do that. I mean, that is, you know, right up there with like bringing pigs into the temple. I mean, you're just violating the most sacred things we have. And so naturally the Jews protested against this. They wanted to meet with Pilate. Pilate refused to even meet with them. They kept protesting and protesting. Finally, Pilate agrees to meet, but in the meeting kind of brings in sort of his local Roman cohort and basically threatens to massacre them all right now unless you guys just put an end to this protest. And the Jews looked at Pilate and said, fine, we would rather die than allow this to happen. They call this bluff. And Pilate knows, well, if I sort of massacre a few hundred of these Jewish rabbis, that's not going to look good. News of that will get back to Rome. Okay, fine. And he backs down. And he either has them killed and he pulls the banners out of the temple. Now, again, what do they learn from that? What do the Jewish leaders learn from that? We can force this guy's hand and he'll cave. Right? We can force this guy's hand and he'll cave. A second incident happened in the same way. This time it had to do with the Praetorium, the palace. He had, again, some shields that had the symbol of Tiberius. He's the current emperor. Again, with some inscriptions that kind of honored him as a god brought in. And the Jews do the same thing. They kind of appeal right to Rome.
And Tiberius, who, well, I appreciate the honor, but I have no intention of spending money trying to keep Jews happy, you know, because we're bothering them, just take them out and go put them somewhere else. There's lots of palaces over there. If you want to honor me, go to a one in a Gentile city where they don't care. And he orders Pilate to have the shields taken out and put in a Gentile city and decorate your palace there so that we don't offend the Jews. And again, the takeaway for the Jews is that, you know, I can always appeal over your head. And so that's the problem that Pilate has. He's dealing with these same people, right? The very same people. He's only ruled there for probably 6 to 7 years at the most, depending on how you want to date it. But just a few years. So the same people, he's confronted these same rabbis, these same leaders of the Sanhedrin all this time. And he knows it, and they know it, that if he doesn't do what they want, they can appeal to Rome, and Rome is going to listen. So that's Pilate's problem. And he's trying to get out of this. The first thing he does, he continues to try to appeal to sort of a Jewish sense of fair play. He says in verse 14, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion." Right? I hear the charges against him. Right? What did they say? He has been misleading our people by telling them not to pay taxes and setting himself up as a king. Right? Those were the sort of two charges they brought against Jesus. So he says, "You brought him to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. Behold, having examined him, I find no guilt in this man." You know, I've looked it over. I've examined him. I think he's okay. And then he tries to sort of back that up by saying, "Nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us, nothing deserving death." So I've looked it over from the Roman point of view, kind of examined him as a threat to Rome. Sent him to Herod, who's kind of examining it from a Jewish point of view. And we both agree that this guy is no threat. But then look at what he says. He says, "Therefore I will punish and release him." Okay, just kind of think about that for a second. Right? I've examined him and I find him innocent. Sent him to Herod. He examined him, found him innocent. Therefore I'm going to punish him. Well, how's that all work? What are you trying to do? What Pilate is trying to do is do enough damage that he can pacify the crowd. Right? I'm obviously not going to get away with sort of letting him go. You're not going to allow me to do that. But maybe if I beat him really bad and punish him and scourge him, you know, will that be okay? Will that be enough? I think just as a side note, it is worth just kind of stepping out of our narrative for a minute. You know, we talk about Jesus as a sacrifice. And I put a quotation in there from Peter where he describes Jesus as a lamb unblemished and spotless. Is not it amazing to think that even the people that crucified Jesus couldn't find a fault in him? Right? The people that ordered his execution, both from the political point of view and if you look at Herod, could find no reason to do so. What an affirmation of the sinlessness, the character, the quality of Christ, that even the people that want him dead, they just can't find something. They can't find something. So Pilate, working the crowd, says, "I will punish him and release him." He admits he can find no fault. He admits that the local Jewish king can't find any fault. But he's got this crowd and he's got to do something. He is simply giving in to the masses. They want punishment. They want something to happen. And Pilate says, "Even though I can't find a thing wrong with this guy, how about if I just beat him up?" Now, Jesus has already been beaten up enough, right? That started the night before. But he says, "Let me just punish him, and then you can have him. I'll just release him. Let him go." Well, that doesn't work, right? Pilate is trying to get rid of this. He's tried to dismiss the case. He's tried to pass him off to Herod. Now he's trying to sort of put a punishment on Jesus and end it that way. Nothing is working. And then Pilate has some sort of brainstorm.
right? And I don't know how this happened. Scripture doesn't say. We don't know if some, you know, smart aide kind of whispered in Pilate's ear, or if it just occurred to Pilate, hey, Pilate, remember, at Passover, you always release a prisoner. Oh, that's a way out of this. I can play the, hey, I'm a nice guy, it's Passover time. And that's how I can kind of get Jesus out of my troubles without either looking like I'm giving in to the Jews or offending them by not punishing him. Good thinking, okay? It says it occurs to him that he was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner. Now again, just parenthetically, I know that in our Gospel of Luke, that's one of those marginal note kind of things, but it's in Matthew and Mark, so I don't think it's worth concerning ourselves. I think its reliability is clear. And frankly, we have in the historical record, I didn't put it in your notes, but in the historical record, we have Roman sources that attest to this being the policy. The Romans realized that not all of their local governors were good people and really ran their sort of provinces very well. And this was a way of trying to sort of throw a bone to the people they governed. So every once in a while, take a bad guy and turn him loose because you do enough things that make them mad. Try to do some things to make it nice on them. So we know that this goes on. This is Rome's way of trying to placate the people that they rule. So Pilate is going to play on Jesus' popularity with the masses, right? Again, know what Pilate knows. He's been in Jerusalem this whole time. He's heard of the triumphal entry, right? He knew that happened. No doubt he did the research to figure out, okay, who is this guy? What's he all about? He knows the masses are on Jesus' side. He knows that some of them have wanted to make him king. And so this way he can, hey, I'm sort of going to appeal over the heads of the Sanhedrin and these religious leaders to the people themselves. Right? I'll give the people what they want. That's always a good play if you're a Roman ruler. Give the people what they want. He's going to give the crowds what they want. The leaders can just deal with that, and he doesn't lose any face. Now, here's what Mark's gospel adds, because Luke does not give a lot of details about what's going on, so I put this in there for Mark's gospel. It says, now at the feast, he used to release for them one prisoner whom they requested. The man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. The crowd went up, began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? Right? For he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. The chief priests stirred up the crowd to ask him to release Barabbas instead. So this conversation began, again, whether it's the people shouting it to Pilate, whether it's Pilate getting the idea, but this becomes something where he says, how about I release this guy, your king? I know I could execute him, but I'm going to give you your king. He's your king. You know, I'm just that kind of guy. You guys, don't say thank you. I'm good. That is a lot better option than releasing Barabbas. Okay? What do we know of Barabbas? Well, Barabbas is somebody that, as it says, was who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Okay, what did we say Romans 1? Taxes and peace. Insurrection, opposite of peace. Right? This Barabbas, his very purpose seems to be to try to overthrow Rome. Again, we don't have a lot of the historical record of that. Probably a zealot. You know, again, one of those members of the Jewish sort of branches that wanted sort of physical force used to drive the Romans out, right? Remember, we talked about this before. Within Judaism, in their occupied areas of Judea and Galilee and all that, there's kind of those that want to cooperate, those that feel we can't cooperate, we'll just be separate, and those that say, let's try to drive them out. And that's who Barabbas is. He's one of the ones that wants to drive out the Jews. This is not the guy you want back out on the streets, right? This is a guy you want in your prison. You want him crucified. Jesus is just some harmless rabbi, right? So here's Pilate's problem. He's thought of a solution, and it's just made his problem worse. Right now, he's being compelled to set free somebody who wants He wants to crucify, and now he's got to crucify somebody he wants to set free.
So there's some negotiation going on here, right? Pilate's saying, how about Jesus? Oh, Barabbas. Well, really, Jesus? King of the Jews? No, we want Barabbas. Oh, you know, Jesus, you know.
And while that's going on, somebody comes to Pilate with a note from his wife. It says his wife sent him a message. This is in Matthew's gospel. Saying, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. So Pilate's wife has this dream. She's superstitious enough to kind of think that she ought to warn her husband in case if he gets involved in the execution of this righteous man, the gods will be against him. Why do I mention that in the story? Because again, as this negotiation is going on, Pilate is appealing to the masses. The Jewish leaders are trying to respond to Pilate, and Pilate has to go now deal with this message from his wife. What? What do you want? Okay, wait a second. Okay, well, tell her I'll be back in a minute. And while he's doing that, the leaders work among the crowd. Say, we don't Jesus, we have Barabbas. Tell them we have Barabbas, please. The leaders begin to work the crowd. Okay? Think about it. It's the early morning hours. People are getting up, going about their business. They had Passover the night before. Right? They're hearing about something's going on at the Praetorium. What's going on at the Praetorium? Word begins to spread. The numbers of people are increasing. Okay? They heard it's that rabbi, the one that was teaching in the temple. Had to be a lot of people that said, really? What did he do? He was great going there. Okay? These are the people that had approved of and endorsed and sung Hosanna to Jesus a few days before. And the religious leaders are working among them, trying to turn them against Jesus. Right? Think about it. They had listened to him. No doubt they had nodded in approval when Jesus had confounded the Pharisees and Sadducees. And all of this is going to just dry up because the Jewish leaders are making their case. We don't know what the Jewish leaders are saying, but my guess is it was probably something like this. Hey, this really isn't about Jesus or Barabbas. This is about what we want or what the Romans want. This is about Roman rule over us. We need to assert our rights. We need to assert our authority. This has nothing to do with this, but just because Pilate wants to release Jesus, let's make him release Barabbas just so we can show we're in charge here. My guess is that's the kind of conversation that's going on. Because they have to turn the people against Jesus. So now Pilate is stuck. Right? He's offered a substitute. That hasn't worked. He seems like he's got no other choice. Verse 20, it says, Pilate wanting to release Jesus, Pilate addresses them again. So he's just going to keep this conversation going. Pilate, this is not about his wife's dreams. This is not about sort of Jesus' innocence or guilt. None of this is relevant. What is going on right now is that Pilate is realizing that his problem just got worse. Because now, not only do I either have to back down to these Jews and lose face, or stand up to them and risk a riot, but now I have to let this guy go. I got to put Barabbas back on the streets again. He has made his own situation far worse than it was before. He's appealing to the crowd, and the crowd won't do it. They don't want Jesus. Pilate shouts to them, then what shall I do with this Jesus who is called the Christ? According to Matthew's gospel. And Mark adds mockingly, him you call King of the Jews. Right? You kind of get the feeling Pilate is about done with this conversation. Right? He got woken up early. He is not having a lot of fun. So now he's beginning to mock them. The cry came back loud and clear, crucify him, crucify him. Okay. He said to them a third time, why, what evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore, throwing him a bone again, I'll punish him and release him. He appeals to their sense of justice. That's not going to work. He offers some sort of punishment. That's not going to work. The intensity is increasing. More and more people are getting there. You can just see pilots staring out as people are beginning to file in the Praetorium, gather in the streets outside, and all he can do is smell a riot. It says, Luke writes, they were insistent with loud voices. They were asking that he be crucified, and their voices began to prevail. It's the same word that Luke uses in an earlier gospel, or earlier part of his gospel, when he talks about the crowds kind of pressing in on Jesus. Right? This almost has, I mean, the imagery I get is almost like sort of an overthrowing pot that you're boiling. Right? You're heating it, and it's just beginning to overthrow, and there's nothing you can do about it. Right? The mood of this crowd is not going to be changed. It's not going to be dissuaded. The crowd is not a mob. Right? There are hundreds, maybe a couple thousand people gathering around, and they have turned bloodthirsty. And if they don't get what they want, they will not go home satisfied, and Pilate cannot talk them out of it. Matthew writes, Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but a riot was starting. So he's got a choice. I've tried everything. I tried getting rid of him. I tried sending him to Herod. I tried offering him to let him go. He has no choice. He's got to choose between either protecting himself or protecting Jesus. And so Pilate, Matthew has this, in an act that this has become sort of, I mean, this is sort of one of those cultural things that we've all seen. He washed his hands of it, right? He takes some water and he sort of publicly washes his hands to demonstrate his innocence. I think one of the things that's interesting about that is that's a Jewish thing, right? Think of the mockery involved in this. He's actually going to do a Jewish ritual to demonstrate this. Here's what's in Deuteronomy. It says, if a slain person is found lying in the open country, in the land which the Lord gives you to possess, and it is not known who has struck him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance of the cities which are around the slain one. It shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd, which has not been worked and which is not pulled in a yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve and to bless in the name of the Lord. And every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. All of the elders of that city, which is nearest to the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands did not shed his blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. And the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them. So shall you remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. Pilate had ruled over these Jewish people enough to learn their ways. And what he learned was basically, to paraphrase this, if there is some sense of homicide, somebody's found dead and nobody knows or we can't figure out who it is, your way of sort of affirming to the people that you had nothing to do with it was to make this symbolic sacrifice and to wash your hands. And this was the way you let the people know, look, I'm telling you, I had nothing to do with it. I might have been the one nearest, but this is not my doing. And Pilate demonstrates that to the Jews himself. He takes a basin of water, he washes his hands, and he announces, this is not my problem. The crowds, and this is just disturbingly chilling, assume full responsibility. When Pilate says that, what do the crowds say? His blood shall be on us and on our children. His blood shall be on us and on our children. They accept full responsibility. There's no qualifying here. There's no saying, well, now, you are the political authority. You know, we can only do that in agreement with you. We really can't have him killed. You know, that's why we're here. So we're in this together, right? No, they say, fine. You want nothing to do with it? No problem. All us. We take full responsibility for this. They appropriate to themselves the death of Messiah. Peter will remind them of this after Pentecost in that wonderful first sermon. Peter kind of gets to the end of it with this. He says, men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. You nailed him to the cross. Yet you used the Romans by the hands of godless men, but you did it. We were here when you did it. We heard you say you did it. Pilate gave in. Verse 24, he pronounced sentence that their demand be granted. And then he released the man they had been asking for, right? Who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder and delivered Jesus over to their will. Matthew's gospel adds that before he did that, though, he had Jesus scourged. He punished him anyway. Why? Just out of meanness? Probably. Probably just for the trouble this guy had caused. Pilate, in frustration, just orders him, okay, we're going to let him go, but first, take him out back for a while. John's gospel elaborates. Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. Soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns, put it on his head. They put a purple robe on him. They began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and to give him slaps in the face. This is what Pilate does to a man he considers innocent. Pilate, who had said, "Do you want me just to do this and release him?" He's just going to do it now out of spite. Luke doesn't go into the details here, so I'm going to borrow a little bit from John to kind of fill in the gap. But scourging was a significant punishment. Often people would die just from that. If you were handed over to be crucified, the scourging itself was often enough that it would be sufficient to kill you. The crown of thorns, the robe, these are just symbols of mockery, right? A crown and a robe for a king. Matthew puts in that they actually gave him sort of a stick to hold as a scepter. So they're sparing no expense here. They bow before him, they kneel, they role play this King of the Jews thing. They slap him, they hit him. Remember, Jesus had received the beating the night before, right? He's already got wounds that are a few hours old, right? When the Sanhedrin had beaten him the night before. So now they're just adding to that. After they've had their fun, Pilate has Jesus brought out to the crowd, and he says, "Behold the man. Behold the man." The chief priests and the officers cry out, "Crucify, crucify." And then they begin to justify their behavior by saying this, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." Pilate's job is to govern, is to rule. And part of that means he needs to maintain local laws. So he gives in to these Jewish leaders. He tries at one last point even here to get Jesus to offer some defense. Jesus, remember, has said nothing publicly. He had a conversation quietly with Pilate before. We had the whole "what is truth" thing before he sent him to Herod. Right? To Herod, he didn't say anything. Now he's back with Pilate, and he's been quiet the whole time. Jesus has received the physical punishment without speaking out. Pilate tells him, "You do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" In other words, this is your last chance, Jesus. I've tried everything I've got to get you out of this. I've played all the cards in my hand. I tried to let you go. I tried to get you to Herod. I tried to release you as sort of the Passover gift. I'm out of options. Do you have anything to say? Don't you know that I'm having you killed? And Jesus finally breaks his silence. And again, he says something that I got to believe just sent shivers up Pilate's spine. He says, "You have no power over me, no authority over me, unless it's been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin." This is happening, and the crowds, again, beginning to wonder what's taking so long. We want this guy. And so the Jews make one final sort of shout from the crowd. And listen to what they shout. "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." That's the last card they play. That's their trump card. Hey, you don't want to get on the wrong side of Caesar. The only reason you're the man that you are, the only reason you're in power, is because of Caesar's favor. Do you really want us sending a delegation to Rome, talking about the fact how you're supporting this rebel king against Caesar? Come on, Pilate, enough stalling. Hand him over. And Pilate gives in. He simply says, again, in a way of mockery, he says, "Behold your king," and he hands him over. What a story. You know, a couple things come to mind as we kind of get to the end of this. One, I think of Barabbas. Now, I know nothing, and Scripture says nothing about his eternal soul. Okay? But it is interesting to me that the first sort of immediate effect of Jesus being crucified is Barabbas being released. Kind of interesting that, at least in a physical sense, the first guy redeemed by Jesus is a rebel and a murderer. That's the first guy to benefit, physically at least, because we don't know what happens to his soul. But I think that's a great illustration for us who think that, you know, who did Jesus die for? Well, in a sense, he started with Barabbas. He started with Barabbas. I think the other thing that I just keep coming back to, and I've said this before, and I'm just going to say it again because it's something that just permeates this, and so I'm sure I'll say it in the future, is that this entire event that we are looking at in such detail has been planned by God for one reason. Because he loves us. Again, there is nothing for him to gain from this transaction. He had nothing to gain by creating us. He does not need our praise and worship. He is perfect and complete. And yet, he created us. He forgives our sin. He dies on the cross for us simply because he loves us. That is an extraordinary thing to try to get your mind around. With a story that I know we all know probably too well to really appreciate, because it's one of those things we just kind of heard and heard and heard. But can I just encourage you to kind of step back and reflect a little bit on the love that God must have for his children to choose to do this for no other reason. For no other reason. So Lord, we just thank you for that. We cannot repay the debt. Even our best actions, our godly lives are unnecessary to you and to your kingdom. They don't add to you. They're simply ways that we can, in our physical fallen sense, try to participate in the kingdom of God and try to honor you by our efforts. And it's good for us to do that. Lord, but even our best works mean nothing to you. This is entirely a one-sided transaction. You chose us. You chose to love us. You chose to die for us simply because you chose to do that. And Lord, that is extraordinary. And I just pray that you will help me and help these others continue to think about this and try to get our minds around the great and wonderful love of our God. Amen.